Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
There are days like today where I am just too busy to get outside and go feed myself. And that's where DoorDash comes in. It's super convenient and they bring the food to me. Also, I don't like paying delivery fees. So I have DashPass. DashPass is an exclusive membership from DoorDash that gets you unlimited $0 delivery fees on eligible orders and members-only deals and discounts, all for only $9.99 a month. DashPass actually pays for itself in two orders on average. DashPass makes it easy to save at restaurants, grocery stores, and all your local favorites. Open the door to $0 delivery fees and savings you can't get anywhere else. Sign up for DashPass today only on DoorDash and get your first 30 days free if you're a new member. Subject to change, terms apply. From Wondery. How you doing tonight, Aaron?
Hey, Justin. How are you?
I'm great. We just got done with our thing at Panic Fest. It was a lot of fun, and I ended up going back and watching a few movies, too. So it's kind of cool stuff.
Yeah, by this point, it's been a few weeks, but it was a really good time. We had a great crowd and meeting everybody, and we passed out some new pins that we have that are pretty cool. Yeah. And it was great to hang out with Charlie from Crime Lines.
Anything else in the news today?
Well, for those of you who don't follow it, we do have a blog at genypod.com. And one of our recent posts is all about the new details that were revealed in the Jamie Kloss abduction case. For those of you who don't quite remember, October 15th, 2018, Jamie Kloss was abducted from her home at gunpoint by a 22-year-old who murdered her father and then her mother, who was trying to protect her. A really sad case. She went missing for 88 days and eventually she got away and got the attention of a driver. She essentially rescued herself. It's an amazing story of survival. For those of us who had followed the case, we always had questions about, you know, what was it like for her while she was gone? The psyche or the mindset of her abductor, those details have kind of come out. You can find out more at our blog, but essentially, he had some guilt after killing her parents, and so he couldn't follow through on all the plans that he had for her. Now, this isn't to excuse this guy. This guy's a piece of garbage. He murdered Jamie's parents. It's just interesting to see how over time, it's like he let his guard down more and more. And no doubt, this is partially due to Jamie's own instincts. The story, while it's so tragic, has at least a good ending, because so often when we hear a young girl has been abducted, we get bad news. And in this case, while she did lose her parents, she survived and now she lives with relatives. Hopefully her future will get brighter.
Hey, stay tuned. At the end of the show, we have some promos we'd like you to hear. We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, 15% off your first order with code WONDERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Now, tonight's case, some think is a questionable case. You're going to get my usual disclaimer. Aaron and I are not advocates, nor do we follow narratives. We simply look at the evidence and give our own personal analysis. And we try to be as unbiased as possible. So with that, what are we talking about tonight, Aaron?
Well, tonight we'll be talking about the abduction and murder of a young girl, a 12-year-old named Sarah Cherry. This takes place July 6, 1988 in Bowdoin, Maine. Sarah was born May 5, 1976 to Deborah and Gilbert Cherry. Her mother would later divorce and remarry. What you should know about Sarah, though, is growing up, she was really into sports. She was into baseball, basketball, even cross-country skiing. She was in the Brownies and the Girl Scouts. And she was in the gifted program at school. So her mother, Deborah, later became Deborah Crossman. She married Christopher Crossman, who had two daughters of his own, Jacqueline and Jessica. Together, they had a daughter named Hillary. At the crux of the story, though, Sarah, who was 12, was going to babysit for a couple who were busy with work, and they needed someone to watch their 10-month-old named Monica. This was the Henkel family. Jonathan and Jennifer. It was arranged about a week before for Sarah to go over there. She was going to be picked up by the father sometime after 8. As he put it, her job would start at about 8:30. Before she went, though, she got some good advice from her mother. Deborah was telling her, hey, just like at home, when you're over there, do not answer the door. If you do answer the phone, don't let anyone know that the parents aren't home, that you're alone. You know, just what some people would say are common sense things. But when you have a child, you're looking out for them and you're just trying to make sure that they're reminded of the important things.
Now it's on July 6th of 1988, where she's babysitting. And at around noon, the mother calls back to the house to check on things. And Sarah picks up the phone and they talk for a bit. She said that she was feeding the baby and she was about to make herself some lunch. It was 3:20 p.m. when the mother, Jennifer, came home. She first noticed that there was some paper, like a notebook, in the driveway. And when she picked it up, it was a car repair bill slid inside of a notebook, so like a receipt. She saw that the garage door was slightly ajar, that the house was unlocked and closed. She went inside. The TV was on. She found Sarah's glasses folded neatly by the rocking chair. She had her jean jacket, her shoes, sneakers, and socks were all in a neat pile next to the couch. Everything seemed to be in order. There was no sign of disarray or anything was out of place. She went to find her baby asleep in her crib, but she searched for Sarah, and after about 30 minutes, she started to get very concerned because where is the babysitter?
Yeah, before we get to the 30 minutes, she first called her husband at work, and she said, "Our baby's fine. Monica's in the crib, but I can't find the babysitter." John was like, "Well, maybe she's outside with friends or something. Maybe she figured the baby was asleep, so she went outside." But Jennifer looked around and couldn't find her.
I mean, she's a 12-year-old girl, so it's not like she's 16 and has her own car. And where they live in Maine, it's a little secluded. It's not like their closest neighbor is right next door. You know, there's some space, but there's nowhere for Sarah to walk to, really, I guess is what I'm trying to get at. There's not like a convenience store right down the street. It's a little bit more rural.
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense because of how wooded all the yards are and the distance that she would have to travel to go to another house. So I think that was wishful thinking on John's part. Either way, after Jennifer can't find her and she spends around 30 minutes just trying to figure out what's going on, she called the police and she also called Sarah's mom.
So again, she got home at around 3:20. She speaks with her husband and then ends up calling the police and Sarah's family. Her husband will end up coming home between 4:20 and 4:49. The deputies and investigators are already on site. Jennifer showed the officers the notebook and the receipt that she found. On this receipt, there was a name for the customer, Dennis DeShane, and it was for a 1981 Toyota truck.
Yeah, it had to do with an auto body appraisal for repair work. And so on this receipt, it showed his vehicle. It's pretty amazing. So they have this piece of evidence just sitting in the driveway because it very much looks like this girl was taken. There's no reason for her to have just left.
And if you're investigating a kidnapping, an abduction, and you have a receipt with somebody's name on it, that's going to be your first lead. So this is, you know, 1988. They pull out the old phone book and look up Dennis DeShane. And they find that he lives not too far away.
Now, John Henkel, he actually goes driving around because he wants to see if he can find a red Toyota pickup. And he's gone, I think, about 45 minutes, but he doesn't find one. There are some reports from neighbors about things they've seen. At this point, the police are focusing on a red Toyota pickup and on Dennis DeShane because the evidence was just waiting in the driveway. I don't think we said it, but when Jennifer pulled up in her driveway, she noticed this and actually avoided it because it stood out to her. Like, what's that doing in the driveway? They have a tightly compacted gravel driveway.
They also notice that certain parts of the driveway are dirt, and they find that there's a tire track in the dirt. And luckily, nobody has driven over it, so it's intact.
It's kind of a faint track, but it's enough that they'll use dental stone so they can lift an impression out with it for comparison later.
One of the neighbors told the police that she heard a vehicle slowly going down the driveway at around 1 p.m. She also heard the Henkels' dogs barking. About 15 minutes later, she saw a red Toyota pickup truck heading north, but she wasn't positive it was the same one that drove to the house or not. She just saw a red pickup truck. So we have a connection there. At around 8:45 p.m., a woman named Helen was driving home with her husband when they saw a man walking across the lawn of her mother's home. Helen's mom's house is about 700 feet from her own. So they stopped the car and they asked the man, "What are you doing?" Because he's on her mother's property.
Yeah, these were the Buttricks, and they had just got back from going to the grocery store. So they had groceries to unload, but they still want to know what this guy was doing because this is not a common sight for them. He said he's from Yarmouth, and that he's just visiting Bowdoin. And he says, "I've lost my truck." He was out fishing, because they ask him, well, if you've been fishing, where is your rod and reel or whatever? And he says, oh, I tossed it off the side of the road, but he wants to find his truck. And so they offer to help him. But even before he goes with Harry to go find the truck, he helps them bring the groceries into their home.
Hmm, what a nice guy.
And he asks for some water.
Now, they notice that he looks slightly disheveled. He has some dirt on him and some cuts and scrapes, but nothing really out of the ordinary. And he's nice enough to help them carry in the groceries. So they're going to be nice enough to help him look for his truck.
They said his manner and the sound of his voice, everything seemed normal. So Harry and Dennis drive off to go look for his truck.
At 9 p.m., police receive a call from Helen saying that she had just interacted with a man who had lost his truck. So the police are thinking, that's interesting. We wonder if it's a red Toyota. And they're going to come and check it out. She tells them that Dennis and Harry are out looking for his truck, so they go out and find him.
And they do locate both these gentlemen. They say, we can help Dennis find his truck.
Because they have a receipt from the driveway of where a 12-year-old girl had just gone missing with Dennis's name on it. And they have no problem helping him. So they put him in the back seat of the police cruiser and they start asking him questions.
They actually drive him to the police command center and they read him his Miranda rights.
Now, Dennis tells them that he's left his truck in the woods, went fishing, but couldn't find his truck when he was leaving. And he didn't know anything about Sarah's disappearance, and he didn't know anything about the notebook. But when the police say, well, there's a receipt in here that has your name on it, so how do we have this? Where did this come from?
Yeah, if it's not yours, why does it have your name on it?
Yeah, you're claiming you know nothing about this, and it's literally a receipt that's dated, what, the day before?
It's a very recent receipt. And the fact that he's saying it's not his, they know he's now having to change his story. The items are his.
Yeah. So then he later comes back and admits that, yeah, this is it. When they ask him, how did these items end up in the Hinkles' driveway? He says, well, whoever grabbed that girl that's missing must have placed him there to set me up. So we still haven't found his truck, but he's already saying that somebody's going to take items from his truck and place them at this girl's house to set him up.
Now, in order for someone to do that, they would have had to have stolen his truck, drove it to the house, and then drove it back.
Now, they could have done that, but they asked Dennis where his keys were, and he said that he had locked them in the truck or they were with the truck. So maybe they opened the truck up, found the keys in it, and drove around. But then the cops find that the squad car that they transported him to the police station in, a set of Toyota truck keys underneath the seat where Dennis had crammed them. So another lie in his story of, yeah, the keys are with the truck, but no, they actually were on my person. So who could have stolen the truck when he had the keys the whole time?
And he said he never drove down Lewis Hill Road. So that's further proof that someone else must have driven his truck.
They told him that they had a witness that saw his truck on Lewis Hill Road that day. And now Dennis admits that it might have been him. But he just said he's never driven down that road. But now he's saying he has. So they're like, why did you drive down that road? this is kind of odd that you're going back on this.
There's an officer named Leo Scapino. He actually evaluated Dennis's physical being. He was looking for any kind of cuts or bruises or marks. And he saw a 1 to 2.5 inch scratch that was on the back of his left arm in the bicep area. There was also a bruise, and then on his right knuckle in the middle, there was a circular scratch. All of these appeared fresh. In fact, they would note that over time, that bruise would get larger. So it seemed to be a fresh bruise that was setting in. They didn't see any obvious blood on him, but we'll get to that later. At around 12 in the morning on July 7th, Dennis DeShane's truck was found. The truck, when it was found, was locked. Justin, what do you have to say about this? I mean, is it possible that if someone did steal it, they locked it later?
Well, that's the interesting thing is, you know, you can use a Slim Jim and jimmy a lock in a car and hotwire a car and drive it without the keys. But according to the detectives, this truck had to be locked from the outside. If you merely push, you know, the little thing down, the little lock down, and then close the door, it would push the lock back up. So you had to get out of the vehicle and use the keys to lock the door. The truck had not been broken into, had no signs of being hotwired or anything. So the truck sat parked exactly where Dennis had parked it, which was not too far from, well, we'll get to that in a minute.
A state police detective named Alfred Hensby also talked to Dennis DeShane. This was about 2:40 in the morning, and he was asking Dennis, "Did you take Sarah?" And Dennis denied it. He said, "I would never do that." He's looking him over, and he sees that there's a handprint on the back of Dennis's shirt. There were faint scratches on his right side, but they didn't draw any blood. Dennis explained this all as, "Well, I was swatting flies, and I'm walking through the woods, so I'm getting scratched up a little bit." You know, Dennis has changed his story from, "I was fishing," yet they can't find any rod and reel. And they looked because they even found a dump where they found, you know, a fishing rod, but it didn't have the line going through the eyelets.
Unusable.
I mean, it was old. It was junk. And he admitted, "Well, I wasn't fishing. I was doing drugs."
Now, he claims he was doing speed. And he said that his wife didn't like him doing drugs at home. So he would go out in the woods and do it. Now, I don't know what kind of speed he had. He just refers to it as speed or some sort of amphetamine. Typically, speed is ingested by, you know, just swallowing it in a pill form. But I guess you could mash it up and snort it, or you could even maybe cook it up and shoot it up. But regardless, I don't really get why he would have to go out into the middle of some random woods to do this. He lives on a pretty large piece of land with lots of property, lots of wooded areas in his own backyard. But he's claiming that he's doing drugs and he's doing them out in this particular wooded area on this particular day in a red Toyota truck that was seen at the location of an abduction along with his notepad and a receipt.
In the end, they took some pictures of Dennis DeShane and then they dropped him off at home around 4 a.m. Justin, what did they do wrong?
They let him go. That's what they did wrong.
But more specifically, they didn't take his clothing into evidence.
Yeah.
This is a guy that's their main suspect right now. And if he has any evidence on him, well, it's going home with him.
I mean, for all we know, he could have a bloody knife in his back pocket. Did they check him? I don't know.
The police do get his truck. They take it and they go through it with a fine-tooth comb. This is a truck that was described as cluttered, disorderly.
Yeah, it looks like he's been living in the truck.
The inventory of it is like 180 items.
Something they do find in the truck is a yellow nylon rope.
It's like a spool of it, actually. And this comes into play a bit later. They find fingerprints in the truck. Some of them are Dennis's. Like they find one on a magazine, another on a beer bottle. But there are some fingerprints that are not his, but are not Sarah's either.
They're looking for signs of Sarah, whether it be clothing, hair, what have you, but they're not finding any sign of Sarah.
And the only blood they found was on what they determined to be an old tissue. The blood on it appeared to be very old.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free
at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles, and immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
So they're looking at the Hinkle's house for evidence. Of course, they're finding fingerprints because you're just going to find random fingerprints everywhere. But they do not match Dennis or Sarah. They look at the tire imprint that they observed in the driveway. And just from a quick observation, it is very consistent with the tread on Dennis's truck.
Yeah, he has a front left tire that at least seems very consistent with it. Although what they found was there was nothing definitive. There was no like special marks on that tire tread to indicate that it was a specific truck's. They don't do any real testing on the papers, the notebook, on that receipt, because it was handled by Jennifer Hinkle and then by an officer.
Multiple officers, really.
Yeah, so in the end, there's not really any reason to test it. Plus, it has his name on it.
Yeah, it's his. So they continue searching for Sarah's body, and it's on July 8th, 2 days after she went missing, that they found it about 400 feet across the road from where they found Dennis's truck. 400 feet isn't that far.
And her body wasn't out in the open, was it, Justin?
No, it was in a pile of brush, buried in all kinds of undergrowth and pine needles and all kinds of stuff.
One of the searchers actually bumped into it. And when they did, it dislodged some of that brush and part of her body was exposed.
Like I said, this was 400 feet from Dennis's truck and about 500 feet from the road and almost 2 miles from the Hinkle residence where she went missing from. She was partially buried and they found that she had been bound and gagged. Now, her mouth was stuffed with a bandana and a scarf was wrapped around her neck. Her hands had been tied with, wait for it, a yellow nylon rope.
There are some sensitive details in association with what they found when they discovered Sarah's body. So a little bit of a warning right here. But they ended up finding 2 sticks that had been inserted into her as if she was assaulted with them. Now, they did use a tracking dog. They gave the dog Dennis's scent. They wanted to see where Dennis had gone, I guess. They wanted to see if the dog would take them to important spots. They used items that had come from Dennis's truck to see if the dog could then walk around the truck and to other places and see if it went anywhere interesting.
And the dog is essentially going back and forth between Sarah's body and the truck's location, right? So we have a connection here. And it's determined that that scarf that's wrapped around her neck came from Dennis's truck. And we can assume that that yellow nylon rope, I mean, it's in his truck, and it's used to bind her. You can go anywhere and find yellow nylon rope, but come on, it's 400 feet away and it's been cut. It's pretty obvious it was the same rope used from his truck.
It will be analyzed later by a forensic chemist who will give testimony on that. They have Sarah Cherry's body, and that means they're ready to make an arrest. So the police head to Dennis DeShane's house around 2 in the afternoon on July 8th. When they drive up to his home, Dennis and his wife Nancy are just there on the porch. And before they can even get out, Dennis is moving right towards their police car. And out of his mouth are words like, "I can't believe I could do such a thing. The real me is not like that. I know me. I couldn't do anything like that. It must be somebody else inside of me."
Now, this is according to the approaching officers. Dennis will later claim that he just asked about Sarah and if they'd found her and who could do something like that.
And if he was getting arrested.
Yeah.
We already have two different stories happening here between the police and Dennis.
So the police search his house and they asked his wife, Nancy, if Dennis carried a knife. She said, yes. It was a little pen knife and it was on his key ring. When they looked for it, it was gone.
Yeah, Dennis said it had been lost for a while, but his wife was surprised by that because she said he always had it with him. And the reason they're asking about this is because they noticed some small puncture wounds on Sarah's body. They're small. So a pen knife would fit with that, but this pen knife is missing. There was a jackknife found in his truck that would have a much larger blade. It's not a very large knife, but it's larger than a penknife would be. They could tell by its state that it had been there a long time and covered with debris. So what was Dennis charged with?
Intentional or knowing murder, depraved indifference murder, kidnapping, and 2 counts of gross sexual assault. When they're booking Dennis, he became very emotional, was crying, saying, "Oh my God, it should have never happened. Why did I do this?" Again, this is according to the police officers who are writing everything down. They claim that Dennis also said, "I don't think it actually happened until I saw her face on the news. Then it all came back to me. I remembered it. Why did I kill her?" You know, this is an admission, right?
It's sort of an admission because unless you have it on audio recording, unless you have a statement where you write down, you know, like when he says, "I didn't think it actually happened," etc. If they don't have that written down and have him sign it, it's not an admission. At that point, it's what the police said he said, and they can try and hold it against you, but it's not actual proof.
Now, once he's in the county jail, it said that Dennis told 2 correction officers, "You people need to know I'm the one who murdered that girl, and you may want to put me in isolation or solitary. Separate him from the rest of the prisoners because obviously child murderers don't get treated well in any sort of institution."
Dennis is going to go to trial. We're going to get into the autopsy soon, but I do want to say that when they ended up trying to collect Dennis's clothes, and they did collect them, they were hanging on a clothesline because they had been washed.
Well, you had to do laundry that day. You know, when you're out sweating in the woods, you have to go home and clean your clothes.
I want to start by saying that the time of death in this case is very much contested depending on which side you're on, whether you're of the belief that Dennis murdered Sarah Cherry or if you think that he had been set up, if he had been framed. But what you should know is the autopsy did find that Sarah Cherry had been strangled to death with a scarf. She had been grazed and stabbed multiple times by what appeared to be a penknife in the neck, head, and chest. And that these marks, you know, they were so small, the doctor actually said that he wouldn't be surprised if none of the blood that came from these wounds got on the murderer. So in his opinion, you wouldn't really see blood evidence on him. Sarah Cherry was buried on July 12th, 1988. And more than 200 people were there for the funeral. Justin, Dennis DeShane goes on trial March 6, 1989, and his trial is held in Knox County. His attorneys, they wanted a change in venue. They said if it had been held in the county where this happened, that he wouldn't have gotten a fair trial.
Yeah, I mean, I get that, but they have a pretty solid case against him. His truck was sighted at the scene of the crime. There's tire tracks there. There are items from his truck that were used in the murder. And there was the notepad and receipt in the driveway of the house where Sarah was babysitting. And then you have the assertions that he confessed when they were detaining him and arresting him.
Not only that, but all of his lies. I mean, as soon as they would ask him something, he would lie to them. He even lied to the Buttricks. You know, where are you from? He lied about that. He lied to the police. Oh, I went fishing, or I never drove down Lewis Hill Road, or I was never in that driveway. And then later, he's giving them a good description of the home. Like, he knows which way the driveway goes and what the house looks like. And he's admitting that he did go into the driveway and said he urinated on their lawn.
Yeah, so let's pause there for a second. He said, I didn't drive down that road. And then they say, well, we have people that saw you. I didn't go to that house, but now... Oh yeah, I went to that house. I know what it looks like. I had to use the bathroom real quick. So I drove down this secluded driveway to this house and peed in someone's front yard. But he has to go out into the middle of the woods to do speed? Okay.
Yeah, at first he had said that he was looking for a fishing spot. That's why he was driving around in the area. But as we know, the fishing story, well, it didn't hold water.
And just going to this house to urinate doesn't hold water either. If he went there, then hey, he was already there and then he saw an opportunity. But the fact that he lied about even going there and then he comes back, So this is where we're at with Dennis going to trial.
The prosecution is making the case that Dennis went to that driveway. Not only that, but he drove up the driveway. This is a house that's obscured by a lot of trees. In fact, everyone on the street is saying, when you drive by that house, you can make out maybe an outline, and that's about it.
It's very secluded. You have to go out of your way to get there. So very inopportune spot to use the bathroom.
It's actually a very good spot if you're going up to abduct somebody. I noticed that the prosecution makes the case that he lured Sarah Cherry out of the house and abducted her. But Jennifer Henkel said, she didn't lock the door on the way out. And, you know, I'm not going to judge her, because if you think about the kind of neighborhood this was, with driveways that are hundreds of feet and go through the trees and all the neighbors know each other and some of them are even family, why would you lock your house?
You could see someone coming from a mile away.
But he didn't need to lure anyone to the house. All he'd have to do is go up and try the door. That's from her own testimony. So what do they have? They have all this evidence. I mean, you could say it's circumstantial, but they have a lot of stuff on him. If you factor in all the lies, all of the physical evidence, all of these items came from his truck. And of course, at first he's denying it all, and then he's admitting to it. You have his changing statements with the police about whether he did it or whether he didn't do it. As they say, the most guilty man ever, or the unluckiest man ever. But I think when you spend, you know, so much time lying, that's not unlucky. That's a guy that's digging his own grave at that point. But he does have representation. And his attorneys tell the jury, which are made up of 5 men and 7 women, that Dennis is an intelligent man, but he's incapable of harming anyone. All of these witnesses who gave statements and stuff, you can explain it away. Like the man who said he saw the truck with the broken headlight, which is exactly the damage that his truck had and why he got an auto body appraisal. He was first shown pictures of the truck. There were 2 pictures shown to him. And the man said, yeah, when I saw the front end of it, it just hit me. That's the truck I saw. All these witnesses who described him got like the color of his shirt wrong, or I think pretty much all of them said, I didn't see his face.
They just saw a red Toyota truck.
Yeah, but one witness actually saw him walking. And the way they described him, it's like no one saw his face, now except for the Buttricks. They also said that there is no evidence in his truck to say that Sarah was ever in there. I think the prosecution does a great job of explaining, if Sarah has her hands bound and they're up underneath her neck, they're bound together, How is she going to leave a fingerprint? There's no guarantee you'll leave a fingerprint even if your hands are free. But in this case, the odds are really against her leaving a print. And think about it. He had said so many times that someone must have taken his truck.
But he had the keys.
Let's get back to what the defense is trying to do here. They point out that there is no evidence on Sarah showing that he was there with her, that he's responsible for her death. But again, the prosecution says his scarf, his rope. Judy Brinkman was a forensic chemist, and she gave a lot of testimony because she went through many items in the truck. She's looking for trace evidence, which are hair and fibers, etc., or serological evidence, which is any kind of bodily fluids. And she's also looking for things that she can measure to look for a pattern. And she found no blood except for that on the tissue there in the truck. Couldn't find any evidence that Sarah was in the truck. She also went through the clothing that was taken from Sarah's body. She found blood on Sarah's bra and shirt. That blood was from her. The hairs found, nothing really came of this because hair evidence isn't exact. You put it under a microscope and you look for similarities, but all they could find was some hairs were animal, some hairs were similar to Sarah's, and some were dissimilar. There was nothing really to go with on that. She also said that when she was looking at the ropes, all the ropes were yellow. They had the same twist direction, same amount of tightness. And she said when she took them, she had to keep arranging them over and over again until she found under a microscope that she could make it one piece of rope. So she could actually put the end together and make them all work as one rope. And that's important because she said, yeah, you can pick up nylon rope anywhere, but this was yellow nylon rope. And being able to look under the microscope and look at these things in detail, she was able to figure out how it went together originally. Now, on the passenger seat in this truck of Dennis DeShane's, they found papers. They were giving requirements for third-class bulk shipping. There was also an insurance appraisal from the body shop. So that ties in with the receipt. Now, Dennis DeShane, his clothing was useless because it had been washed. But he did have two sneakers, and there was one drop, tiny drop of blood found, one found on each sneaker, and they tested it, shown to be blood, but there just wasn't enough to be able to run a test to see if it was animal or human or to go any further with that testing.
And DNA testing, not really a thing in 1988. So they're trying to go for blood types and other analysis, but just wasn't enough.
Also, another thing that was kind of discussed was at the house where Sarah was babysitting, at the Henkel house, there were two dogs that were tied up in the driveway. One of them could get within a closer distance of the house, but they were both kind of tied up where someone could easily go around them and go to the house. Now, the dogs would bark, but all we know is from the neighbors, they seemed to bark more on that day than normal, but it didn't get anyone to get up and go over there, if that tells you anything. So the dogs were barking more, but it didn't really raise any alarms. I guess some of the neighbors were saying it was sometime between 1 and 2, I guess, when the dogs were barking even more.
And if the mother came home after 3, well, that kind of makes sense that the abduction would take place sometime between 12:30 when she called and, of course, 3 o'clock. So 1-ish for the dogs barking makes sense.
And the prosecution also tries to lay out a timeline that they know that in the morning, sometime after 10:30 or 11, Dennis DeShane took a truckload of chickens up to be slaughtered. He had time that afternoon. Of course, according to Dennis, he was doing drugs. But, you know, everyone that had met him, none of them gave any kind of indication that they thought he was on drugs. So you can say it's perception, but there were a lot of people that talked to him over the course of that day and night and the next day, and none of them described him as looking like he was on drugs.
And when it comes to speed, I guess I'm looking at that, I'm like, well, you give me enough coffee or energy drinks, it's going to have the same effect. Are you going to say, oh, Justin's wigging out on caffeine today? It's not outwardly apparent that he's on anything. When you realize that he said he was doing speed, well, that makes sense.
Dennis DeShane did testify at his own trial, and he said that he had nothing to do with the abduction or murder of Sarah Cherry. he said that he never said those things that the police are saying he said about how could I do this? I should have never driven down that road or any of the things that he supposedly said.
Now, I want to stop here because he took the stand and testified. Normally, you don't do that because the prosecutor is going to shred you. But Dennis has this very innocent look about him. He comes off of very sincere and well-spoken. He does not come off as creepy at all. If you watch any interviews with him, you might watch that interview and be like, I think he's being honest. I don't think he's lying. So it was kind of a good strategy to put him on the stand because I don't think he comes off poorly when speaking to people.
I think the other reason they had to put him on the stand was because it's like anything else. You have to weigh your options. And in this case, they felt like the prosecution had a hell of a case on their side. So what they needed to do is let Dennis defend himself. Let him go out there. He's convincing some people that he didn't do this. So let him work on the jury. Let's see if he can get their sympathy and say, hey, I'm not convinced he did this. They don't have anything nailing him to the wall.
So they say that he went into the woods and injected the drugs. In the interviews that I saw with him, he said it was speed. So he's shooting speed up. I get that he wouldn't want to do that at home, but driving to another location to do that, a little weird. And then he got lost out in the woods. Didn't remember where he put his truck. He thinks he left it unlocked, yet he had the keys and you have to use the keys to lock the truck, but whatever. And he claims that he followed the sound of a generator out to a dirt road. And that's when he came across the couple that helped him look for his truck. He claims that all his lies were based around him trying to obscure the fact that he was doing drugs out in the woods. And he panicked. He was paranoid.
That also explains supposedly why he hid the keys, because he had said, I left them in my truck. And then when he later realized he had them, he thought, I better hide them.
I think that if I was doing drugs and there were a bunch of drugs in my truck, I would hide the keys because I'd be like, yeah, you got to break your way into my truck. I'm not going to give you the keys to just go into it. I don't know. That would just be my idea.
But he does something weird on the stand, which is he says that he told the police immediately about the papers, the notebook, and the receipt. That's what he chose to say. He, of course, drives home this point that he is a nonviolent person and that he gets upset even at the sight of blood. It's important because anyone who supports Dennis, they say this constantly. This is almost like a mantra. You know, this guy couldn't hurt a fly. Why would he abduct and murder a 12-year-old girl that he didn't even know?
And he really doesn't have any history of violence. He admits to a history of drug use. But why would this relatively normal guy just go out and target a young girl one day, do these horrible, heinous things to her, and then come home and act like nothing's happened? It's very much out of his character.
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
The jury takes, what, 10 hours to decide Dennis's fate? They come up with guilty on all counts. This to me isn't
surprising.
Yeah, isn't surprising because they have such a case against him.
any listeners right now, like, you're like, why is this a mystery? Why are we even talking about this? You know, obviously, he was at the scene of the crime and his truck was found just hundreds of feet from the crime. Why are we even talking about this?
I think it's because this case is very much a puzzle that's been mostly filled in, but not all the way. And you have some key pieces missing. You know, I said that the house was unlocked where Sarah was babysitting. So it's possible he just went in. But the narrative that's out there is, well, how did he get her out of the house? She was told not to open the door for anyone. What was unlocked?
And she's 12 years old. There's so many ways to explain that one.
To me, it's a gaping hole. It's not, oh, how did it happen? No, there are options here, especially with an unlocked door.
And it did happen. So do we really have to explain all the finite details of how somebody could have lured or got access to a house? We have the little girl's body. We know she was at this house. Did she just run away in the middle of a babysitting job and get abducted by somebody on the road? No, they took her from the home. So he gets a life sentence without the possibility of parole, because in Maine, they don't do that. He gets 20 years for each of the two sexual misconduct convictions and 20 years for the kidnapping conviction. He's not getting out anytime soon, at least while he's alive.
So let's go over some of the appeals, because at the center of his appeals is forensic evidence. I talked about the puzzle. They don't have all the details about, you know, connecting him specifically to the murder in the woods, other than his items are found at all these places. And that's what connects him.
Yeah.
And for those of you who aren't, you know, sold on this idea, this type of evidence where you can say this came from his truck, this came from his truck, this came from inside his locked truck, and then was found at the scene, that stuff's important because it does show a connection. Yeah, we don't have video of him. We don't have his DNA all over. What we do have are all his items left at all the important scenes.
The old saying is, this is a circumstantial case. Yeah, most cases are. And direct evidence is typically eyewitness accounts, which, hey, we have a bunch of eyewitnesses that saw him or his truck around the area. Some of them got the color of his shirt wrong, which is interesting because I was just watching a documentary the other day. Some of the surviving victims were up on the stand and they were just point out the perpetrator of the crime. They said, are they sitting in this courtroom right now? And they're like, yes, please tell us what color shirt they have on. They're sitting 20 feet away from the perpetrator who killed their family member. Person's wearing a pink shirt. They say, oh, they're sitting right there. It's red. Right in front of their face. They described the shirt as red as opposed to pink. So if somebody sees a red Toyota pickup truck and then gets the color of the shirt of the driver wrong, I can't throw that out. They saw the truck. And how many red pickup trucks were in the area? Oh, that's right, one. And it was Dennis's.
I'm going to try and shorten this part of the appeals because the fingernail clippings are a big deal. At least on the Dennis DeShane side of things, they say that DNA was found on the fingernails, that is not Dennis DeShane's. But when it was tested, it was said that he could not be excluded. And why is this? Because the amount found was so small that it's difficult to test. The other thing you should know is the places that these fingernails traveled to. Okay, we'll start at the morgue when they were clipped. They were clipped with nail clippers that are used on many, many bodies. Okay, so they're not decontaminated. They're not sterilized. And then from there, they travel to the exhibit room. They're being handled and moved around by different people. Essentially, it's just contaminated evidence. So on the one hand, you could say, well, that's not Dennis's fault. Right. But again, there's no real reason to believe that this was going to hold any evidence anyway. I mean, the blood that was found under her nails to begin with was hers.
At the time, they didn't have DNA testing. So they didn't know that you wouldn't be able to handle all this evidence for years until they did have this testing come around. So yeah, it was tainted.
DNA did come around shortly thereafter, but 88, that's
a little too soon.
Now, the court did rule that the dual convictions and dual sentences of intentional or knowing murder and depraved indifference murder violated his right to be free of double jeopardy. Now, this is kind of interesting, but it doesn't really change a lot because all it does is it caused the court to change his convictions to a single offense of murder and a single sentence of life imprisonment.
So they just consolidated the charges. Got it. But at no point did they say that any of this stuff exonerated him or this was a technicality. It was just, oh, we shouldn't have charged you that way. So now we're going to charge you with a single murder charge. Got it.
Yeah. And the other convictions that he got, those remain the same. So the defense team later, this is in 2014, had items tested. The items were Sarah's shirt, which was a purple dyed t-shirt, her bra, a scarf, and her fingernails. And they said that this DNA test showed that it was likely someone other than Dennis DeShane that committed the crime. But the results, really, what they show are that the DNA does not exclude Dennis or Douglas. Who's this Douglas guy? Douglas Senecal.
Oh, yeah. Talk about the actual other suspect in this case, or at least the other suspect that Dennis's supporters like to point out. This is definitely at the heart of any innocence groups that support Dennis.
Douglas Senecal's wife was once married to Sarah's stepdad.
So there's a connection.
Douglas Senecal knew who Sarah Cherry was. Now, Douglas was indicted for unlawful sexual contact against his stepdaughter, which is the daughter of Douglas's wife and Sarah's stepdad. The defense's original theory that they wanted to put forth in Dennis DeShane's trial was that in mid-July of 1988, Douglas killed Sarah so that she wouldn't testify against him in a trial. And so Douglas Senecal set up Dennis by framing him and putting his notebook and receipt in the driveway. And Douglas owned a truck that was very similar to Dennis's.
So the connection is Douglas was once married to a woman who was once married to Sarah's stepfather. And he had pending charges of sexual assault against one of the daughters. So he takes that and he abducts Sarah, kills her, and is able to get access to Dennis's truck that Dennis happened to go to Sarah's house on the very same day at the same time that Sarah was abducted, and then follow him to the woods, get items out of that truck, go back to Sarah's house and abduct her using these items, and then leave items at the driveway. Okay.
This will only not feel like a stretch if you're supporting Dennis DeShane. And the reason is because at the heart of their case is the time of death. There was an estimate that put her death at a time when Dennis was in the custody of police.
So this window of time for her death is 3 p.m. Wednesday to 3 a.m. Thursday. A lot of documentaries and testimony puts it at around midnight, the night of her abduction. And if you remember, Dennis was in police custody, or at least was with the neighbors earlier in the day and then police custody at that time. So how could he have killed Sarah if he was with other people or in police custody is their question here. And if you go specifically with the time of death, well, she was probably abducted at around 1 p.m. that day. And they're saying the time of death was 3 p.m. and Dennis was looking for his truck with neighbors. But the advocates will say, no, she wasn't murdered until midnight that night or much later because she had very little decay, no signs of rigor mortis.
But the argument against that is that she was buried in brush. No one could see her until they hit the brush and then some of it fell away.
She was cocooned. She was protected from the elements. And they're using the hot day out. So they're like, oh, it's 90 something degrees out. So she should have decayed at a faster pace. And then you take into account that she's buried with plants and dirt and all kinds of stuff. Well, Is she going to decay at that same rate? We have today the, I think it's called the body farm, where they'll take a pig carcass and try to completely reproduce the same exact environment that a body was dumped in to see the rate of decay. So all we have is this autopsy trying to determine time of death based off food digestion and the amount of rigor mortis. This isn't exactly a perfect science here. So obviously the prosecution and the state does not feel like it's that big of a deal. And obviously the jury who found him guilty didn't think that it was a huge point of contention. But for Dennis's followers, they're saying he couldn't have done this. He was in police custody at the time of her death.
But I would remind everyone, even if you're starting to go down that road, you still have to explain how a guy who lied about everything, even hiding his keys in the police car, is somehow innocent of this. I mean, his evidence is everywhere. You have to explain away a lot of things to make this work for Dennis. It's nice that people want to defend people who they feel are being railroaded, but in this case, it's a real stretch. I mean, I went through all of the trial transcripts trying to find something, anything that would provide a better defense for him than what I've been hearing, because this whole time of death thing isn't doing it for me.
That's where they start, is with the time of death. And then from there, their next biggest point of contention is the detective's own notes writing down Dennis's confession. The officer had written down, "How could I kill her?" And then he crossed out "how could" and wrote, "Why did I kill her?" So "why did I kill her" is an admission, whereas "how could I kill her" is, "I couldn't have done this." And according to the officer, he just kept repeating both of those phrases. How could I kill her? Why did I kill her? So he crossed one out because he was just trying to write quickly. But again, he was saying these things to multiple officers. So you have to assume that all of these officers got together and said, well, what are we going to say he said to us? And then align their stories. Or he was saying these things. Now, Dennis claims that he never said these things and that he was so high on drugs that he doesn't remember most of the night. It's interesting. He's so high on drugs, he doesn't remember most of the night, yet not high enough to know if he's killed somebody or not. So with this, you have time of death. You have a discrepancy, apparently, in the detective's notes. And from there, you have this other suspect that they are really hammering home as the actual perpetrator of the crime. And this suspect, they say, planted the notebook and the receipt, had taken these items from Dennis's truck. But the mental gymnastics one has to do to come up with this is ungodly. And I really want to try to be fair here, but how would he have known, this other suspect, where Dennis was that day, unless he was following him around?
Some of the evidence in this case has since been incinerated. One of those items was the rape kit. Now, the testimony at trial indicated that seminal fluid was searched for in Sarah's body, but they didn't find any. So I'm not sure what this kit would have done if they had kept it around. But apparently this is enough to set people into a rage.
Well, we would all like to have all the evidence kept around forever indefinitely. I'm one of those people. But there are budget constraints. There are storage constraints. And sorry, but when you have such an airtight case against somebody, this is probably a low priority evidence box to keep around. Because, well, why are we going to retest some of these things when all of this evidence pointed to this guy? He was found guilty. And in most of the appeals, all they've come up with is some technicalities of how he was charged, but not anything that would challenge the evidence. Now, again, I would like them to keep the evidence around. I would like them to DNA test these things. But like we said, all the evidence was handled so much by so many different people. Could we really get any sort of DNA profile off of it that would be usable? And if we did get Dennis's DNA profile off of it, it would easily be explained away as transfer DNA. So what's the point? You know?
And we had mentioned Douglas Senecal as being a suspect, at least according to the defense and Dennis's supporters. There was also a pedophile that lived in the area. You know, I don't understand the time spent on these angles simply because people are having to explain away all the evidence pointing at Dennis. We have zero evidence pointing to these other people.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem is they say, well, there was another pedophile in the area. There were some other abductions that happened nearby, something to that effect, but they weren't nearby and they weren't exactly at the same time. And when you have evidence pointing directly to Dennis, they keep saying once they locked onto Dennis, their blinders were on, probably as they should have been. You'll never hear me say that in most cases. I'll say vet all the evidence, vet all the suspects. These other people weren't suspects because none of the evidence pointed at them.
I think this case is proof that it doesn't matter how much evidence seems to be mounting against an individual. Anyone out there, especially these days, can have a support group, can have people out there fighting to try and reverse the conviction, try and free the person who many believe is a murderer.
So on the website trialanderrordennis.org, there are some questions that they pose. The first question is, would a guilty man lock the doors of his getaway vehicle while struggling to remove his kidnapped victim? Well, yeah, I would. And his kidnapped victim is a 12-year-old girl that's already been bound. Why wouldn't he lock his doors?
Yeah, he just tosses her out of the truck and then locks it.
That's a weak question. Why would he take his victim across a public road in broad daylight when he could have taken her into the woods on the same side where he parked his truck? Because this is a very rural area. There aren't cars going down the road all day long. There's no traffic. Maybe he had a place already planned out across the street. And maybe he's so high on drugs that he just doesn't care. To his own admission, he said he was high out of his mind. Question 3, why would a guilty man with a stream bed blocking the way just beyond where the victim was killed get so lost when he could have just simply returned to the road so he could leave the area? Well, if you're high on drugs and you just murdered a little girl, you might become disoriented. While fleeing the crime scene, give his real name to strangers when they offered to help him. Well, I guess he couldn't come up with a fake name that quick, but he came up with a fake location of where he was from and a fake story of fishing poles. So I don't really get that.
Yeah, just blame Dennis for that one.
Would a guilty man eager to escape get into a stranger's vehicle and voluntarily enter a police car searching for the same girl he just attacked? Absolutely. Because he knows that if he doesn't, it's going to make him look even more suspicious. And to his own admission, just having his car keys on him made him look suspicious. So why wouldn't he get into the cars? Again, these questions aren't very hard to answer here. We're going to keep going. Suppose that he had tortured his victim, be unable to kill his own chickens or even take blood samples from his own animals. Do I know this for a fact that he can't kill his own chicken? And if he's so high on drugs, maybe he lost all of his inhibitions and was able to kill a little girl.
Now, this whole argument seems silly because many people who have chickens take them to the processing place. It's not that they can't. It's just you're doing this in bulk. You'd rather drop them off there and have them do it. And not only that, but maybe he valued animal life above human life.
These next two questions, again, are going back to the truck. Help the police hunt for his truck, especially if he had just kidnapped a victim. Or give police permission to tow his truck to the lab to search it extensively. Again, if he had said no, it would have made him look even more guilty in this situation. So, yeah, he's going to give them permission to do these things. Again, these aren't hard questions to answer. The final question is, request an offer to pay for DNA testing prior to a trial. Well, there are tons of accused who offer to pay for DNA testing because they know it's kind of a crapshoot. If it comes back inconclusive or is somebody else, they could be exonerated.
Or at least there's doubt.
But it's the context of the DNA, where it was found. There's all kinds of things there. I don't care if I was absolutely guilty of a crime. I would say test it all.
Look at it this way. We already went through all the evidence against him. At that point, what does he have to lose?
Exactly. So if these are the solid questions that are found on this website that are supposed to get me to question his guilt, shake my belief in whether this man abducted and murdered a 12-year-old girl, give me something more solid here. These are weak arguments. I didn't even read these questions prior to this episode, Aaron. I literally read them right now and gave you off-the-cuff answers. You could have woken me up at 2 a.m. from a slumber, and I could have given you answers to these questions. I'm in utter disbelief that this guy has any support out there, and it's ridiculous to me to see the advocacy in a case like this. I don't get it. And I watched all the documentaries. I literally had to turn one off because I felt dumber after watching it.
For those that miss Sarah, I've had to deal with the trial and, of course, all of the support for Dennis DeShane. It's been very difficult, but I kind of get it because in this day and age, we've learned so much about how many people have been wrongfully convicted. And there's this idea that we can make a difference. This is what's going to happen. You know, you have a lot of well-meaning people trying to help who they believe is a person who's been wrongfully convicted. And so they're doing their best. But not all of these people who are considered to be wrongfully convicted are actually wrongfully convicted. The statistics work every which way. You have a high number of people who are wrongfully convicted. But sometimes, as you said during our live show, sometimes the person actually did it.
Hey, thanks for listening to this week's episode. We'd like to introduce you guys to some other podcasts that we've worked with and love. This is Esther from Once Upon a Crime.
Are you looking for another true crime podcast to add to your favorites list? Once Upon a Crime is a weekly scripted true crime podcast that tells the story behind the story of real life crime. I dig into each case to bring you all the details of the crime, the criminals and victims, to uncover the why behind some infamous crimes, as well as fascinating lesser-known cases. Presented in a storytelling style, Once Upon a Crime takes you deep into each case to discover details you won't hear anywhere else. Every month, a new true crime topic is covered. Killer kids, deadly duos, mass murders, tragic deaths of music superstars are just some of the series covered on Once Upon a Crime. With over 150 episodes to date, and new episodes released every Monday, you'll want to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can find Once Upon a Crime on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, and all other podcast apps.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.